a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we're flashing back to July 21st, 2011. This was originally episode 707. This was one of the first episodes we ever had with Stephen Harris. It was on biofuels for personal energy independence. And I need to stop here and say a little bit about the Stephen Harris years. They were good years. Stephen Harris was a valuable contributor to the Survival Podcast. For those that weren't around back then, you might hear me with the past tense and think that he's passed away. As far as I know, that has not happened. Right prior to the beginning of COVID, late 2019, Stephen Harris and I parted ways. It was not mutual. It was 100% me. I basically told him he was no longer part of the expert council or would be part of our community if I had to say anything about it. Stephen is a very smart man. We did a lot of episodes together. He's probably the person, you know, outside of expert council, because that's every week for some of them. But as far as guests, he's probably the person still to this day that's been on the show as a guest more than anybody else. He had a lot to offer. And like a lot of smart people, though, I think he had an issue with anybody that didn't know what he knew was dumb. It's just the way he came off constantly. And that's a shame. And it's something that a lot of people, as brilliant as this man is, have as a problem. And I feel like they don't understand. If people knew what you knew, you wouldn't have any value to anybody because you wouldn't be able to help anybody because they would already know what you know. And it's too bad. And there were multiple issues. And I just want people that maybe were part of these years to, you know, if you didn't hear it when it happened the first time, to know. I don't hold anything against him. It was just he was becoming a cancer inside the community. He was abusive to people. I know this doesn't sound like a great introduction, but I'm getting there, okay? Because the guy really did help us a lot. But he was abusive to people. He talked to people like they were dirt. And I want people to know this because it's important to me that you know this. I went out of my way. I had many conversations with him about this. I did everything I could to resurrect that relationship and to make it work. I put him in timeout a couple of times, brought him back around. He said he'd change, and he went right back to it. There were two things in the end that made me say, look, it's not about me disliking you or whatever. It's just like I can't have you here. And those were, he literally cussed out and put down and crapped on a 16-year-old kid who, when he found out he was a 16-year-old kid, said, I treat everybody the same. Well, no, you don't if you're going to be decent to people. And he had worked his way into a leadership role in Citizens Assisting Citizens, which was a nonprofit I helped found for disaster relief. And he was incredibly abusive, just verbally and bullyingly to everybody else in that organization who had actually built it before he got involved. And those two things together and the way that he talked to people, I decided that what we did was good for the time that we did it in, and it was time for us to separate. So I won't do this again. I won't explain this again if I do it. And the only reason I did it today is I know that when I put this out, but whatever happened, right? Here's your explanation of what happened, right? It was right at the time of the workshop of 2019 that he was just over the top. And I have to say, I don't know what happened, but as far as the way he talked to me, it got worse and worse. And he began to become very paranoid. And I use this as a cautionary tale for y'all.
when you are in this world of preparedness, there's only two places you get to. You come to a place of peace where you realize you do what you can, and then, you know, fate is what fate is. And you are more relaxed because you're aware and prepared. The only other place people end up in the final destination of this is total paranoia. And it seemed like he got there. And that made all of the issues worse. And when COVID-19 hit and the way he went off on Facebook on people and freaking out and over the top and the world was ending and when the viral load this and the you're going to die that, I couldn't have been happier that I had parted ways at that point. And it's sad. And if Steve ever rights the ship, and I believe it, I want you to know he would be welcome back. It would take some effort for him to even get back in contact with me because things went on for a while and I blocked him in every way possible because I didn't want to keep having it shoved back at me. I still consider him a good person. There's just certain things certain people shouldn't do, and being a talk show personality in any form just wasn't his strong suit. So I wish him well. I hope things are going good for him. And I will tell you, this is the first of many interviews we did, and he was incredible, and especially at this time. This is before things really got off sideways, and for whatever reason they did. Again, I wish Stephen well. I didn't even want to do this intro this way, but I felt I owed it to the audience because I know, well, what happened? Because every time his name comes up, I get that question. So as far as flashbacks go, I'll just remember episode 43 and say, if you have any questions, listen to the beginning of that. This episode is excellent, though, because we do go into the way to produce biofuels for yourself. And any products or information Steven is still selling today, I still endorse it as a product. Just if you reach out to him and talk to him, you might get the nicest man you ever met one day and really wish you didn't even ask the next. With that, let's go ahead and flash back to July the 21st, 2011. All right, folks, and as I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate to have with us today Stephen Harris, who is an expert in biogas, among many other things, and the CEO of Knowledge Publications. Stephen's a consultant and an expert in the field of energy. He's the founder and CEO, as I said, of Knowledge Publications, the largest energy-only online largest energy-only publishing company in the USA. Mr. Harris came to his current position to do full-time work on the development and implementation of hydrogen, biomass, and solar-related energy systems after spending 10 years in the aerothermal dynamics department of Scientific Labs of Chrysler Corporation, where he was a pioneer member of a group that developed and implemented successful speed-to-market development concepts. And that all means he's a really switched-on guy, and I had a lot of questions about biogas. And preliminary conversation, I've already learned things I had no idea about. And he's here today to help us all learn how we can make this part of what we're doing in our lives for preparedness and just to live a better life altogether. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show, and thanks for being with us today.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. And not to mention about making things better for your life, this stuff is just pure fun and neat.
Yeah, you know, I basically saw some folks doing, we're going to talk about two different types of ways to do this today, but they were doing something kind of like this, and they basically created this little pressure vessel for it, and they lit a flame and fired up an old stove, and I started talking about it, and some listeners said to me, you know, well, what do you have to do with appliances to get them working? They started asking me all these questions I didn't know, so I sent the troops out, and one of them found you an expert, so let's talk about that and how we can do these things today. But first, can you tell folks just maybe a little bit about yourself beyond the bio I just gave them?
Wow, if I'd known that bio was going to be read over the radio to so many people, I probably would have spent a little bit more time writing it. But it's a good description of my background. I've been in the energy field. People ask me, when did you get interested in energy? And I'd say, well, second grade. And I've pursued energy all through my collegiate education, and even when I was a development engineer at Chrysler Corporation, I spent a great deal of work, even consulting on the side in the energy field, doing research and development in the energy field, as well as getting every chance I could to play with the electric vehicle group when EVs were in their infancy back in the 90s. And other such areas. So I basically live, eat, and breathe energy. When I left the corporation, Chrysler Corporation, in around 2000, I went out as an independent consultant into the energy field, consulting on fuel cells, hydrogen production, hydrogen generation and storage, high temperature solar thermal work, biomass gasification, the conversion of biomass over to a hydrogen rich fuel is one of my specialties. And I built up this great library of books because I was always a bookworm. And people kept on asking me about this book and that book and what's a good one for this. I'm going, hey, there's a market for this. So I started Knowledge Publications, which turned out to be knowledgepublications.com, and we publish, license, and or write, and our author and publish DVDs on the best subjects you never heard about, energy, and it's all DIY hands-on. Our main website is USH2.com, like Uniform Sierra Hotel 2.com, which stands for United States Hydrogen. It's a little hard to read over the air, so for any of you listeners who, you know, don't have a chance to write this down, you really want to see everything we're talking about on this show tonight, you can just go to solar1234.com, and you'll have all the show notes and all the stuff that Jack and I are talking about. But yeah, Knowledge Publications has been going since about 2006 on a hard and heavy scale, and we have about 65 books and DVDs that we author and we publish and we reproduce on, from solar to wind to biomass. I got the biggest collection of biomass gasification books there are, to make a fuel cell in your kitchen, to hydrogen production, hydrogen storage, how to run your car off of hydrogen. I don't mean HHO junk. I mean real bottled compressed hydrogen, and other fuels, natural gas, propane, etc. I have a pickup truck. You can see the video on our link to our YouTube site, me driving the truck around off of natural gas from a balloon. And natural gas is a close cousin to the biogas that you were talking about. You'll see me running my Honda generator off of natural gas in a weather balloon floating over the generator. I can pretty much answer a great deal of all your questions you're going to have today about not only biogas, which is methane from anaerobic digestion, but there's another biogas called biomass gasification, which is what used to power 1 million vehicles. 1 million vehicles drove on wood gas, quote-unquote, from a wood gasifier that was on the front or the rear of a vehicle during World War II. And this was in Austria as well as Australia and Germany and Great Britain.
Yeah.
And, it's been used for a long time.
Yeah, I'm completely blown away. I'm already seeing Stephen Harris part 2 and 3 on the Survival Podcast, because I know we're not going to, no way in an hour we're going to cover the depth of knowledge you have. And I think my listeners are going to latch on to you as one of our new favorite guests, honestly, because just what you're saying already just has me intrigued and excited. Before we kind of go deep into that, though, one of the things in your guest survey you filled out was something you're working on called Project Destiny. And I thought that was really cool. Could you tell people a little bit about that, and then we'll get into some meat and potatoes?
Project Destiny is the large-scale implementation of real solar energy that will put this country, that'll basically let the Arabs, you know, sell sand instead of sell oil. I mean, it's to get this country back onto energy independence, and it has to deal with the development of large-scale solar energy. And this is, we're talking about concentrators that are 30 feet in diameter. We're talking about 1,000 square feet of useless desert now turned into a solar energy farm. And it's for the production of hydrogen as well as electricity. It can make methane. It can make the whole variety of chemistry regarding energy. And it's a project between myself and Roy McAllister. And we're going to implement this. We are going to do this. And we're going to end up doing it with our own private money, which is why we founded Knowledge Publications, was to finance our own research and development, because we got tired of dealing with the financial idiots who wanted to come in and invest and take the thing over. They just didn't get it. So, I mean, real large-scale solar energy that can put this country on energy independence is truly 100% possible. In fact, half the technology we're using is pre-World War I technology.
You know, that's what's blown me away. I had no idea how much of this stuff was going on 80 years ago. And it's just like people figured out that oil was, you know, I wouldn't say easy, but profitable to refine, and you could sell it cheap in the mind of the consumer, and all of it just went out the window.
Yeah, and then there's the thing that I call the worst thing that ever happened to the solar industry, which is solar photovoltaic panels. I hate solar PV panels with a passion when it comes to the philosophy of solar energy, because they think they're this great be-all, end-all thing, and you can never, ever get your energy back on a solar PV panel in anything less than 15 years in prime desert sunshine, because it takes so much energy to make the polycrystalline cell that you just don't have enough time in the sun to get the energy back. Basically, you're making the cells with nuclear energy, most of it from Japan, to grow the silicon to be cut into wafers to then be treated to make the cells that you see in your solar panel. And you're just moving that energy someplace where you have sunshine and basically just getting it back. So
that's interesting. And it's I've always had an issue, but I didn't know a better way. But I've always had an issue with how long the payback is. So that's a great setup into one of the questions you wanted me to ask you today, which is, what is the best use of real solar energy that everyone can use, you know, in a disaster or even every day?
I'll tell you, it's so darn easy, and it's fully documented in my book called this book I wrote called Sunshine to Dollars. And I titled that specifically because I want you to realize how easy it is to take sunshine and to convert it right into dollars. In the book, I detail some of the best thermal solar stuff, solar heaters, solar hot water heaters you can imagine, and here is how simple it is. In a disaster, what do you need? You need clean water. And also for your comfort, you need hot water. So if you raise water to above 160 degrees for 10 minutes, you've now pasteurized it and killed most of the pathogens. And if you bring up a near boiling temperature, of course you're even going to get the spores after 10 or 15 minutes. And you can do that. I mean, I did this in Michigan sunshine in the fall, and it got to 185. You go take a door, any door, like a wood door or foam core door, and you lay the thing down. You go find some 2x4s from the building that was blown over with your saw, and you cut a 2x4 frame out, and you screw it together around the top of the door. So you got the door, you got the 2x4s and a frame on top of the door. You lay down some black plastic, like some 4mm black plastic from Home Depot, and then you go find yourself a sliding glass door, which is dual-layer tempered glass. And you take that glass, and you just lay it on top of the 2x4 frame with the black plastic underneath of it. Before you do that, you fill it with about 15 gallons of water. And in no time, I'm talking an hour or less or more, depending upon your sunshine, you will have water so hot it will scald you. I mean, it's nothing for it to get to 185 in Michigan in the fall. You're talking about summertime and hurricane zone and everything else. You're going to have water that's hot and pasteurized that you can then cool down and drink, and or you can then cool down a little bit and you can use for washing yourself for comfort purposes. If it's a colder climate, you can take the water and put it into some 2-liter soda bottles and wrap it up with you at night underneath your blankets and stay warm. Real solar energy is solar heat and solar thermal, and you have to work hard to make it not to happen, because the sunshine will fall and it'll heat stuff up.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but even photovoltaic, basically that's what it really is doing, is converting the heat into energy, but it's taking kind of a long way around, isn't it?
No. Photovoltaic actually uses the photons of light from the sunshine hitting the polycrystalline, and it is knocking loose electrons, and those electrons are then beginning to flow. It is a photovoltaic process.
So it's completely independent of temperature. It could be 0 degrees Celsius, and it would still do the same thing.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It would do that. And a side note, I have a book from that I republished called Solar Heat from 1903.
Wow.
That shows a printing press in France called the Sunshine Press running off of a solar concentrator. It's running off of solar steam, and that's how they printed their publication every week, was with Sunshine, and it was called the Solar Press. And that's detailed in my book from 1903 called Solar Heat. There'll be a link on solar1234.com that'll send you to ush2.com to get it if you're interested. But I republished that book to show people that solar energy is not a new thing. It's an old thing. It's been used for a long time, and it can be used with today's manufacturing and research and development abilities quicker and easier if we just get off of this distraction of politicalness regarding energy as well as the photovoltaics. We can get to real solar energy.
Wow. I wanted to talk to you about biogas, and there's kind of like, you know, biogas is made by the sun, I guess, is some of the stuff you're talking about here. Can you explain to people kind of what you were we were talking about before the interview started about the two ways there are to make biogas for fuel and energy use, and kind of just the difference between the two? Because I think there's, like, I was thinking one way, and you've already given me a much better way. So let's clue the audience in on that.
Well, to answer your first question, everything with a carbon atom in it is made by, right, by the sun. Okay, if you're made from the sun, your clothes, if they're polyester or cotton, are made by the sun. So you could say, yeah, biogas is made by the sun because it grew the organic material that was either digested through an animal and or just grown and put into the biogas reactor to make the methane or the hydrogen and carbon monoxide. So basically there's two ways of making biogas, and they're completely different. The first one is the one that you were referring to in your original discussion, where you take like a 55-gallon drum, you fill it full of manure or manure and grass clippings or manure and leaves, and you close it off and put a hose coming off of it. That will go through 3 days of aerobic with oxygen digestion and produce nothing but CO2. Then once all the oxygen is consumed in the barrel and in the water that's in the barrel, it goes through anaerobic digestion, which means without air. And anaerobic bacteria, when they feed upon the carbon-based energy source, the carbon-based waste material that's in your barrel or your digester, it produces methane. It breaks down the compounds and produces methane and a little bit of carbon dioxide. And this is what you run to your lantern or to your stove, or you can compress and use your car. It's been used in China for decades, if not centuries.
And when you do that, just real quick, because I'm a little confused on this, because you got those 3 days of producing CO2.
Right.
Are we doing something to vent that CO2, or is that CO2 part of why the methane concentration is lower there than with, say, natural gas? Because it's like 60% versus 95%.
No, you just vent it.
You vent it.
Ran it through an airlock and vent it. There's nothing you can do with it.
Okay.
That's just the oxygen-based bacteria consuming everything in there, and then the oxygen is gone, and then the bacteria that don't use oxygen, the anaerobes, take over and start digesting. This is exactly what's done in a wastewater treatment plant. Wastewater treatment plants are generally almost completely self-powered off of the methane they produce from yours and my waste that flows through the sewers and goes to them. So this is one operation of making biogas. Another way of making biogas is called biomass gasification. And this is a high-temperature process where you are partially burning wood and our organic material. Now, everyone knows that a fire gives off carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide is a wonderful fuel. It burns beautifully. So a biomass gasifier, what it does is it optimizes the partial combustion of anything you put in there to produce hydrogen and carbon monoxide, because all organic material is made up of hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen.
So but I thought hydrocarbons were bad.
This is an organic material. This is not a hydrocarbon. A hydrocarbon is nothing but carbon and hydrogen, nothing else. Thus, hydrocarbon. And all organic materials are made up of at least carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. Like cellulose is C6H12O6. Cellulose is C6H10O5. You got me.
That was sugar, wasn't it?
Yes. Sucrose.
Man, I just turned over a brain cell from high school chemistry. Wow. I don't know where that was hiding.
I've been dealing a lot lately with making fuel alcohol from sugar, and that's why it popped into my head. So what you do is you do biomass gasification, and you break down thermally at around 1,200 degrees this organic material, and it produces a very quick and readily stream of carbon monoxide, hydrogen, and nitrogen from the air. So instead of a biomass gasifier, a biomass methane digester, it takes about 3 days to start, and it'll run for about 3 weeks until it depletes its material, making methane and carbon dioxide. A biomass gasifier takes minutes to start up. I mean, you basically light it, turn on your engine and start sucking air through it, or you turn on a blower and start blowing air through it, and it will make a continual stream of hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and nitrogen from the air, which is sometimes called wood gas or producer gas. You can go to Wikipedia and read about those. And plus, if you want to see it done right now, if you go to solar1234.com, you'll see a link to the biomass wood gas stove. We sell a stove that's a lightweight backpacking stove. We throw in Twix and Stigs and everything. You light it and it runs on two AA batteries for like 20 hours, and it will gasify the wood that you put into it and then immediately burn the gas. It makes for a very clean, very neat flame, but we sell the gasifying wood stove to prove to everyone how simple gasification actually is.
It sounds very similar to the concept of a rocket stove, where, it's not the same thing?
Completely different. And we sell a rocket stove. We sell the best rocket stove on the face of the planet on our website as well, and there'll be a link on that at solar1234.com as well. A rocket stove does full combustion, okay? It is actually, and a rocket stove is containing the heat around your fuel, and so your fuel doesn't cool down. And it is drawing in air through the bottom, and it is preheating that air, which is thus making for more efficient combustion, more complete combustion, and then directing that flame upwards directly onto the bottom of a pot. So a rocket stove is actually as opposite of a wood gas stove or a wood gas operation as you could possibly get. If you wanted to run an engine off of wood, off of sticks and wood, wood that fall on the ground, off of wood chips, etc., you would use this gasification process. In fact, our book that documents it the best is called Hydrogen Gas Generator Volume 3 and 4, which is critical to remember. Volume 3 and 4 is the hands-on how-to book of how to take an engine, put a gasifier in front of it, start the engine, and have it gasify the air coming in through the wood to run the engine. And volume 3 and 4 is hands-on, step-by-step, exploded diagrams. I mean, the bottom of the gasifier is made from a stainless steel salad bowl colander that you drill holes through. I mean, this is all off-the-shelf stuff, parts from Home Depot, literally.
So I don't have to be a machinist or have an engineering degree to do this stuff?
No welding. You just might have to cut some sheet metal, bolt some things together, cut a little bit of chain, and you hang the colander with the holes below a piece of not metal pipe but metal sheet metal, like furnace ducting, and you put that inside of a 33-gallon barrel, and then you put a trash can on top of it with a hole cut in the bottom as your hopper, and It's called the FEMA gasifier, is what it's called. And
wow.
It's detailed in the book. So and it works very good. It works very good. I got video of it. If you go to my YouTube channel, and there's a link at solar1234.com, you will find a video of me talking about the book, as well as a video in that video of one of my customers who made one of these and sent me the video of it.
Awesome. So if you can run a motor on it, you can run a generator on it. And if you can run a generator on it, you can make electricity for your house with it, right?
True. Completely true.
Unbelievable. I mean, that we're not doing this is what's unbelievable. Not that it works, that it does work and it's that simple. And my thought is, well, what if people actually got behind it and started innovating and going further with it it seems like we could be running our whole country off of what we're throwing away and raking up and filling landfills with. Can you talk a little bit about the history of vehicles running on biogas? Because that's been going on forever, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah, over 1 million vehicles during World War II ran off this biogas, wood gas, / producer gas, depending on which lexicon you're using. And you might have seen pictures of vehicles with these funny tanks on the front or on the rear of the trunk or something. And this is what people would do because they didn't have gasoline. They would fill up these gasifiers, which consist of, you know, the hot portion, the reactor, and then a bunch of cooling filter and filter material, which was Excelsior or straw or grass or, various other materials to condense the tires out of it, and then it would run to the engine. Now, the energy is what I call kind of fluffy. It's not dense like gasoline. So your 200 horsepower car might be only getting 75 horsepower out of it, but that's more than enough to move you down the road. In fact, when trucks were run off of these gasifiers and they were loaded, many times they'd have a hard time getting up a hill, and what they would do is they'd switch over the gasoline to go up the hill, and then to go down the hill and the rest of their flat driving, they'd turn off the gasoline and just run off of the biogas.
It makes me think of the Daimler motor that's the big V8, and when you're on the highway, it cuts back to four cylinders, but when you need the acceleration, it's there. But, and then I guess the other thing is, because we're not trying to be political with this, we're just trying to do what works. Having kind of, let's say, a hybrid situation, I mean, we're not, okay, we use some gas maybe here and there for what gas is best for. When I say gas, I mean gasoline, but we also can use this stuff for what it is really appropriate for. And what I'm sticking on here is this concept of being able to generate electricity for my house. Now, when I'm doing this, can I build the gas up and store it somehow to use it as needed, or do I have to kind of like use it as soon as it comes out of the chute, so to speak?
It's better to use it as it comes out of the chute because you can make it on demand. Storing it requires a compressor, and the best compressor that most of your public are going to be able to get their hands on is a 200 PSI shop compressor. Now, I have, in fact, taken four propane tanks, and I mean the big 100-pound propane tanks. Not 100-gallon, but the 100-pound propane tanks from Lowe's. And I rigged them together in the back of my pickup truck, and I compressed them up to 200 PSI with wood gas, and I would drive my pickup truck for about 15 miles on this, okay, because I had about the equivalent of 1 gallon of gasoline stored in those four propane cylinders in the back of the pickup truck. So I have done both. If you want to go to a higher pressure, you got to use a high pressure scuba diving compressor, but that alone is $3,000. Then you got to deal with high pressure tanks, and those cost a couple grand to get the high pressure tank. So you're better off using it as you need it. But I have a whole video that does nothing but cover the storage of hydrogen, natural gas, methane, propane, syngas, wood gas, producer gas, biofuel gas in propane tanks, scuba tanks, air tanks, and bladders. Like, I have a picture in the video of a bus in China with a great big bladder on top of it, literally half the size of the bus itself. And in China, they would, and in England during World War II, they would make the gas that we're talking about, the producer gas, the wood gas, and they would store it in a bladder. And they would put this on top of a vehicle, and the weight of a bladder would cause enough pressure, and plus the engine would suck it out of the bladder as it needed it, and they would drive for many miles, tens or 100 miles, just on the bladder of gas. And so my video is called the Fuels Video / Gaseous Fuels. It's actually at ush2edu.com, and there's a link at solar1234.com that'll send you right to the fuels video. And that's like 95 minutes long, and I cover every gas. So you know the difference between hydrogen, methane, natural gas, carbon monoxide, hydrogen, wood gas, producer gas. Not only do you know the difference, so you know how much you can store in any of the containers I mentioned, and you know how far you can drive if you were in a Chevrolet Chevette or a Ford pickup truck or a traditional car. It tells you how far you could drive off of each one of those fuels in each one of those containers. So I go into lots of detail.
Let me ask you this, so I can just make sure that I'm, you know, thinking about these scenarios the right way. Let's say I want to produce electricity for my house, and I'm not going to shut the grid down or anything, but I want to cut my electric bill, and I set one of these things up. It would seem reasonable to me that for some period every day I could go fire this thing up, run a generator off it, use that energy in my home the same way I would use a generator, would bypass the grid in the first place, and when I'm done with that for the day, I go back to using the grid, and that should work just fine.
Yes, that would. And the way you would do that is you would use the FEMA gasifier that is documented in Hydrogen Gas Generator Book, Volume 3 and 4. You would use a 3,000-watt or a 5,000-watt type of Coleman or Honda or Troy-Bilt or whatever, or Generac generator. And if you got a 5,000-watt generator, it would produce about 3,000 watts max, because remember, the gas is not as dense as gasoline. If you wanted 5,000 watts, you'd have to get like an 8 or 9,000-watt generator. So remember, it derates it a bit. But most of the time, your house without AC is well less than a kilowatt, and with air conditioning could be 2 or 3 kilowatts, 2 or 3,000 watts. So you would then hook up the generator to the FEMA gasifier. The generator, as it inhaled, it actually pulls air. Your air intake is before the gasifier. It pulls the air through the gasifier, gasifies it with the hot wood material, which wood chips is a great one to use. And you can get wood chips from long service places. They'll say, oh, how much do you want to take with you? Just, you know, bring drums and bags and take them with you, because the waste material that they have to dispose of. So gasify that, and then it gets drawn into the air intake of the generator along with air. And there's two valves you use, which are fully documented in the book. And you don't need to change timing of the generator or anything, because carbon monoxide burns at the same speed as gasoline does, and there's a lot of CO in this gas as well as hydrogen. And it'll just sit there and it'll run. It'll pump, 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 pump. It'll run at the right speed. It'll adjust for its speed and load just like it does on gasoline.
And what's the average cost of building one of these things? Let's leave the generator out, because that's, do you want a really good Honda or a cheap, you know, Sportsman's Guide brand, you know, but just building this gas fire in your book, if I go out and buy all the stuff and do it, what's it going to set me back?
Anywhere from tens of dollars to $100. It depends how much are you going to pay for your 30 to 30.
But it's not $5,000.
No, it's like a 33-gallon metal drum. It is some sheet metal from Home Depot.
Yeah.
For the vertical column. It is a stainless steel colander, cell.
So max a few $100. The reason I'm laughing is I'm thinking about all these people that set up these little off-grid, you know, kind of cabins and stuff like that, and they spend $5,000-$10,000 or more on solar photovoltaic panels that only work when the sun's out, maybe another $2,000 on a windmill, and they put this big battery bank up. And I'm thinking, not only could they run direct power when they're power, you know, they've got their gasifier running with their generator, but they could set up the same battery bank with inverters in their little cabin that they would have for the solar array, forego the solar array, put a couple $100 in this, run the dadgone thing during the day when you're up and about, and you can keep feeding it once in a while, and also at the same time be charging that battery bank, and when the thing shuts down at night, you've got batteries through the night, and probably several days worth, and it's far more efficient than a solar array panel.
It is far more cheaper, but the thing is, and you know how much I really don't like solar photovoltaic.
You're the first person to say that on the show, by the way, and you've laid out a good case for why.
Yeah, I don't like it, but in this advantage, if you're setting up your cabin, your retreat cabin, solar photovoltaics don't require you to go cut wood, chip it, load it into the gas
fire.
Fair
enough. Go get it.
Right. I mean, you don't have
to. If I'm surrounded by 100 acres of wood with dead trees laying everywhere, and, you know, I mean, it's really not that far of a stretch. And I guess, again, we don't have to throw babies out with bathwater. We could combine those two. We could throw up, you know, a couple panels, maybe 500 watts, a couple 250s, and then supplement this with generator systems and wood and have, you know, I'm big on redundancy, so now I have multiple ways to skin the cat.
Two is one, one is none.
Absolutely. You're going to fit in well around here, man. Is this all safe? I mean, I know there's people out there thinking right now, if I want to start, you know, making gas and storing it or even burning it, I'm going to blow something up.
Well, no, you're really not. You're going to have to work really hard to blow something up. You need to follow standard precautions and safety rules. You don't want air or oxygen to get intermixed into your tank. And, I mean, a cylinder of propane, if you shoot it, it doesn't blow up. It leaks propane, and the propane catches on fire. It doesn't explode. The Hindenburg didn't explode. It combusted because the gas cells are full of hydrogen. And if you look at it, it didn't go kapow. It just burned.
And being painted with thermite didn't help. I mean,
well, actually, it wasn't painted with thermite.
Okay.
It was painted with aluminum, and it was painted with lacquer. And both of those are highly combustible on their own. People like to exaggerate the thermite thing, which I hold patents on. But, I mean, either way, it didn't go kaboom. It burnt. The same thing with a cylinder full of gas. It isn't going to sit there and go kaboom. There's no oxygen in it. There's no air in it. It's just a cylinder full of gas. Now, the thing you got to be careful of course, this is all outdoor stuff. It's all, you know, it's not in your garage. It's outside of the garage. It's not in the house. Because not only is the generator making carbon monoxide through combustion, but your gasifier is expressly making carbon monoxide and hydrogen. And it is real easy to make a whole bunch of CO in an enclosed space, and then you start getting a headache. And, you know, if you can make enough of it, it can kill you.
And go to sleep and never wake up.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a big enough inhale of carbon monoxide, you just fall over. So, their safety precautions are covered in the books, and there's not much that's going to hurt you if you're outside in a well-ventilated area. Because, again, most of the time you're making the gas and it's going right to the generator. You're not storing it, so you're not worried about air getting intermixed into it.
Sure.
And anything else like that. And you're dealing with things that are hot, and this is a nation where you get sued over a coffee cup, you know, being
It didn't say hot on the container,
yeah,
so they didn't know
hot the container.
Was hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
so, I mean, we're talking about this inside the middle of this reactor. I shouldn't say reactor, that's a fancy word, but I mean inside of this sheet metal duct and salad bowl colander inside of a 33-gallon drum, it's running at 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit. And the gas coming out can be hot. You got to cool the gas. You got to filter.
So don't let stupid people with smart lawyers on your property. That's probably the biggest safety advice there. And don't put it in your house. I mean, we don't want to be asphyxiated. Let's talk a little bit about the kind that you would store, though, because I know there's a lot of people out there that are interested in the digestive type of gas, the methane that you'd produce for running, let's say, a stove.
Okay, the methane, the anaerobic digestion methane method of doing this is so easy. It's covered in two books I have. One book is called Biogas 1 and 2. The other book is called Biogas 3. Biogas 1 and 2, which, again, is on solar1234.com. There's a link to it. The way you do it, you take a 55-gallon drum, you fill it up full of manure and water, and the more leaves and grass you can throw in, the better.
And I thought I saw these guys on YouTube, and one of the things they were doing, they were going to like places where they throw away like old fruit and stuff like that, and they were throwing that in there through a garbage disposal.
Oh, sure, dead animals off of the road, anything you want.
Okay.
You throw it in there, okay? And so this is a 55-gallon drum full of the slurry. Then you take, you know, 33-gallon drum fits inside of a 55-gallon drum. Well, you put a hose fitting on the bottom of the 33-gallon drum, and you upend it into the 55-gallon drum until it sinks all the way. And then you close off the valve. And what happens is it starts making gas. The 33-gallon drum rises up within the 55-gallon drum, and the weight of the 33-gallon drum gives you your pressure to force your gas through the hose that goes to your stove or to your mantle and to your lantern. And as you asked me about how do you change things that run from natural gas over to methane-based biogas,
yeah,
you either drill the holes a little bigger,
okay,
which I don't recommend you do.
Okay,
all you do is just up the pressure. Instead of using natural gas coming out of your house is generally at 4 inches of water pressure, you just use a little bit more pressure coming off of your digester, which is basically put a brick on top of the.
So I add weight. So the digester itself creates the storage. Yeah. And I use weight to increase pressure. And how would Joe Sixpack, who's building one of these things, know what his pressure is? Is there like a gauge? You just get a basic gauge on the and a line that's carrying it over to your
manometer. You take a piece of clear plastic tube and you make a U out of it, and you stick it, you zip tie it to a yardstick, and you fill it full of water, and you plug it in, and you'll see the inches of displacement of the water. And really, you don't even need to do that. You just plug it in to your stove, and you try to light it. Oh, the flame's a little low. Honey, go put another brick on top of the barrel.
Okay.
And then he's like, okay, fine, this is the right level. And you can put a regular valve or any type of valve in there. So you can turn the pressure up and down by regulating the size of the hole in the valve. And you can sit there. And again, there's a video of me doing this on my YouTube channel. And the YouTube channel's linked on solar1234.com. You'll see a little picture of a mantle glowing and a big blue flame coming out of the pipe. And
wow, so you could just set up maybe two or three of these so you had them in rotation, you're using it as it's going. You could set that up, you could set up your generator, and you could provide a tremendous amount of your own energy from things other people throw away.
I wouldn't say a tremendous amount. I'd say a usable amount, because you're talking about 95% water, 5% anything else in there. You're making a slurry. It's got to be a nice...
I'm talking about combining both methods. So I'm talking about using the biogas for cooking and then using your wood gasification for energy and using those two in combination.
You can use them back and forth. Now, the second book I have, called Biogas 3, is how the Chinese did it. This book shows you how to dig a hole, a pit, and then you line the pit with bricks, or clay bricks or mud bricks, and then you put a divider in the middle, and you keep on pouring your biomass or your waste into one side, and your digested fertilizer. The byproduct of this process is great fertilizer. So you dump into one side, the fertilizer comes out of the other side, and your gas comes out of the top. So the bigger way of doing it is Biogas 3, the book Biogas 3, and it's how the Chinese did it by digging a great big pit, and then you line the pit with bricks, or you can start off with a 55-gallon drum and a 33-gallon drum, or a 30-gallon drum. They can be plastic. You can do this with plastic drums.
I mean, this is just, to me, it's fascinating, and I kind of want your opinion, and this case ties back into what we started out talking about, your Project Destiny. If the country, this is all neat stuff we can do at an individual level, and I think it's what we should do now instead of waiting for someone else to do it for us. But at a national level, if we got off our collective butts and made a real concerted effort to use these technologies, how much energy do you think we could create for ourselves as a country?
Well, we are already using it on a massive scale. You just don't realize that every landfill is slowly digesting and methane comes off of it. And there, in most landfills, you'll see a flare of gas burning all the time. Or if you don't, then that means they got a set of generators there using that gas to make electricity. And all of your wastewater treatment plants make methane by this way to self-power themselves. And I was talking with people at Los Angeles who have one of the biggest wastewater treatment plants. That's an operation, makes the most methane. I was saying, you know what? If people in California really wanted to recycle and take their waste food scraps and materials and to turn it into real energy, wouldn't you say all they really need to do is put it into the garbage disposal, grind it up, and flush it down the sewer? He goes, yep, that's about it, because it will go through the pipes that already exist to the wastewater treatment plant, and it'll be digested and turned into methane. And the more material they get like that, the more methane they want. So,
so we've been taught the exact opposite, that we should be responsible for our own solid waste, and we should. So, but if you're tied into a plant that's doing that, effectively every time that apple core goes down there, now people like me want to put it in our compost bin because we get a direct result from it, but for other people, that's actually helping that.
It's actually helping it. And people think it's wasteful. It's not wasteful. It's actually contributing to the methane generation at the wastewater treatment plant. There are three things responsible for humans living to an average age of, 77 today. The first one is clean water, as in drinking water treatment. The second thing is wastewater treatment, so our fecal material does not contaminate us. And the third thing responsible for us living so long is antibiotics. Those are the three things that allow our civilization to begin to exist the way we live in cities, is fresh water, wastewater treatment, and if you do get infected, antibiotics.
Sure, because, if you take away those, human beings cannot live at the population densities that we do today.
That's right. That's right. And I would be remiss to mention, since this is a survival podcast, I have all of this and more in a completely free, famous, easy, proven family preparedness class. You can go get it for nothing. It's at beforethestormhits.com, just like it sounds, beforethestormhits.com. Link to it is also at solar1234.com. I talk about great ways of doing food storage that you've never thought of before. It's all hands-on. It's all DIY. We make emergency bread in 30 seconds. And I also have a video. I forgot to tell you, I got this great video called Bread and Gasoline. How many pounds of bread would a bread maker make if a bread maker would make bread off of a generator with 1 gallon of gasoline? And so I took the complete opposite of what you think of what you would do in a preparedness situation. And since we have power, because we make our own power and generate our own power, I said, I want to make bread as easy as I wash clothes. Put stuff in, push a button, come back, and it's done. And I ended up making 32 pounds of bread, 16 two-pound loaves off of 1 gallon of gasoline.
Wow.
That's pretty cheap. That's pretty good food, and that's pretty cheap eating. And that video is 98 minutes long. It's called Bread from Gasoline. There's a link at solar1234.com.
Wow.
But elements of that stuff is for free, completely for free, in my beforethestormhits.com family preparedness class. So once you're making your own energy, either through methane digestion, biomass gasification, solar photovoltaic panels, I have a video coming out in the future called How to Power Your House from Your Car. Once you got this set up and you got a basic amount of electricity, you can then use these automated tools in a disaster that make things for you without you having to do it, like a bread maker. Or a blender, or you can use your microwave oven for a few minutes to heat something up. It turns everything that was useless back into being useful again.
So I am going to come back at you with the original question that got us off on this, though, because, you know, you said we're doing a lot of stuff nationally right now with biogas, like the wastewater treatment plants and all. But clearly you don't think that's enough. You think we could do more. What more could we be doing as a society beyond the individual, as, you know, to create energy independence for us?
That's easy. Stop electing the same stupid politicians to office.
Okay, you just went past Paul Wheaton as my favorite guest on the show. As we're getting close to wrapping, I was going to tell you that I've learned more from interviewing you than any other guest. The only guy that's close was Wheaton. And at that point, now you've just become my favorite person. Seriously, because I say that all the time. Quit ticking the D or the R box. Let's bring some new people in here to fix this crap and stop being stupid. But if we had the right people in and they were going to listen to you and you said, here's some initiatives we can take, what would be some things you would suggest?
As a country, as a whole, boy, Project Destiny comes to mind, but what can be done in your local area is, I have books on every type of energy you can think of, and basically you can pick the flavor that you want and you can do it yourself to make your own energy, and then you become a demonstrator to your community. And this is a fabulous community. You're running your own community here. Okay?
Absolutely.
You become a demonstrator to this community, and you let other people repeat it, and someone says, hey, I got enough of this weight. You know, in my book, Sunshine of Dollars, I have a page called Why Waste is Good. I mean, every new business that starts has been basically started off a waste stream. And when someone has too much of something, they don't know what to do with it. You then use it and generally turns into business. Like you have a buddy who's in the landscape business, and all he's doing is chipping trees all day, and the city's giving him a hard time because his piles of wood chips are rotting. And you're going, I have the ability to take those and to turn those into electricity. And I'm going to then take those electricity, and I'm going to sell it back to the grid. Or I'm going to set it up next to a business and sell it to the business to do peak shaving.
So do you think what's the word I'm looking for? Not deconstructed, but that's not the word I'm looking for. But a decentralized model then is the best way to do this. As many independents as possible generating power and then either selling it or using it or providing it.
Yeah, in fact, it's called, there is a word for it. It's, not DC, got me off on a tangent again. It's local generational power.
Okay.
The way we're going to be going away from, we're going to be supplementing the larger baseload plants, like the nuclear and the coal plants, with smaller power generation that's off of natural gas, that's off of methane gas, that's off of landfill gas. That's being done now, but you're going to see more and more local generational power set up in different areas to supplement the grid and the larger generation of this. And you can buy 100 kilowatt generating plants that will go on the back of a tractor trailer semi. You can buy those on the used market, and you can generate a heck of an amount of electricity and actually get into the energy business if you got that waste stream of energy that you can just pick up for nothing for the price of hauling it away. So you know, first take care of yourself and take care of your family, and then you can begin to go off and conquer the world and change the world. But take care of yourself first, learn about it first, do it yourself first, and then take it in baby steps, and it will self-fund its way into its own business on its own.
Well, folks, I think we've just found a new friend of the community in Mr. Stephen Harris, and I can't highly enough endorse his books. I know I'm going to pick them all up myself because there's so much knowledge there that I just need to obtain, as Steve was saying, for myself, for my own homestead, for what I'm doing here as a business person in the Hot Springs community. So, Stephen, man, thank you so much. This has been one of the best interviews I've ever done.
That's a pleasure, and I have a very serious personal commitment to civil defense, homeland security, personal preparedness, personal survival, and I will be happy to come back anytime and to speak at length on any of the subjects you and your listeners could want, from my flavor of family preparedness that I teach all the way up to energy generation, solar, any field of energy you want to speak to your community. I'm happy to come in and to give the expertise freely away to everyone so it helps them. And again, all the show notes and stuff that we talked about will be at solar1234.com.
And of course, as always, at thesurvivalpodcast.com in the show notes for today's episode, I'll have a link to that site and to all of Stephen's sites. And you guys can get in there and post comments and ask questions. And that'll probably will be what leads to your next appearance, Steve, as the community says, well, how do you do this? How do you do that? And I go, I don't know. Let me get him back on. So, I think you'll be demanded a return trip by the audience, and I always give in to the audience's demands because, let's face it, they're little folks that pay the bills around here. So, man, again, thank you, and I really appreciate the work you're doing to help empower people.
Well, let's get that list of questions. Let's find out what people want to know, and I'll come back and we'll answer them all. We'll get them all answered, and then we'll get another list of questions, and we'll get them all taken care of and sent off in the right direction.
Awesome, awesome. Well, with that,
I'm going to wrap up, folks. Today, this has been Jack Spirko, along with Stephen Harris, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to T-Spaz, that's T-S-P-A-Z, T-Spaz.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.